Hello, everyone, and welcome to Edge Talk Radio. My name is Angela Zabel. That's me. And today we are here with Carl Unubu, and he is from New York. He is a lawyer and he works with comedians. And the First Amendment, and so much more. You don't want to miss this one. So, who am I? My name is Angela Zabel. I have been connected with spirit my entire life, working with the team in the non-physical, sharing messages from a multitude of realms with people. I am a teacher, coach, medium, radio show host, writer, retreat host, gallery reader, speaker, doing speaking engagements, working with intuition and guidance, mediumship. And all of that online. You can find all of that online. I do private and group sessions. And you can also find out more about me with the Amplified Universe membership. This is about our role in the world, why we're here, and what we can do and to help understand our role in the world. You can find out more information about me at angelazabel.com. And you can find me on pretty much all the social media aspects. And today we are here with Edge Magazine. Edge Magazine is the leading events and media resource dedicated to all aspects of holistic living, health, wellness, and the mysteries beyond. Sharing information, or wisdom, resources committed to promoting businesses, individuals, and organizations. Sorry about that. Sharing information, wisdom, and organizations, individuals who support our collective journey to wholeness and balance. We are currently distributed in 30 states plus Canada with 17,000 magazines per printing with a vibrant online presence with over 42,000 people reached per month. You can have a magazine shipped directly to your door. You can stay up to date by joining their newsletter or become a drop spot. And you can check out more about that. And this is one of the magazines at edgemagazine.net. So make sure to check them out. And today we are here with Carl Unubu, and he is by far, there are by far worse things for comedians or comedy actors to worry about. Just ask Dave Chappelle, Conan O'Brien, Howard Stern, Adam Carolla, Charlie Sheen, John Lovitz, Jimmy Kimmel, John Oliver, Jay Leno, and a host of others. What they would be concerned about are the details that keep them out of the courtroom, especially in a country as litigious as the US has become. Carl Unubu, considered the foremost authority on comedy and the law, has written an entire book using comedy legends and others and their cautionary tales that help comedians become aware of ways to avert lawsuits and legal entanglements. Carl is a New York attorney, longtime editor of Comedy Beat website, and subsequently the writer of the highly read blog called O'Carroll's Law. I've been on that. It's got some really good stuff on there, so you definitely want to check that out. In Manhattan called Comedy Dialogue, which regularly served up a great combo of stand-up comedy performances and panel discussions. Carl's new book, Comedy Goes to Court, When People Stop Laughing and Start Fighting, ensures that people who work in comedy arena take the smart steps to prevent the disagreements, contractual missteps, and on and off stage rhetoric and be or behavior that can result in expensive lawsuits. He directly addresses how far you can go and have the First Amendment protect you. There's a lot of lessons here for anyone in the entertainment business, but not just comedians or comedy actors. And even if you aren't trying to make a living telling jokes, you'll find fascinating stories revealing about our society and the world. His book has been described and I've got to say, there's so much more in here as I went through and checked into some of Carl's information too. There is so much there for people who are doing things on the side. If you're moonlighting, if you're doing the side hustle, this is so important to hear some of this information, the legal aspects for you. Carl's new book, Comedy Goes to Court, When People Stops Laughing, is going to be out real. It will be out when this comes out. You can check out more about Carl on his website, carlslaw.com. He's also on LinkedIn and Facebook, and those information will be in the links down below. So I can't wait for you to check it out. There's so much great information with Carl here. And Carl, I'm so happy to have you on here. And I just want to say thank you for being here. And how did you make the journey of going from law to comedy law and the First Amendment?
Oh, thank you very much, Angela, for having me, first of all. And I really appreciate the opportunity to have this moment with you and, you know, discuss this book. First of all, the book is Comedy Goes to Court. When people stop laughing and start fighting, it's a product of my years, like covering comedy, both as an editor and reporter and as a blogger. So it all, I went the whole gamut, really, of talking about comedy, dealing with comedy, working with comedians, and all of that stuff. Now, how did I go from law to comedy? So I went to law school in Miami, and then I practiced law briefly in Miami, then headed off to New York, Columbia, where I studied journalism. And my journey, my foray into comedy began when I was a student in journalism at Columbia. I was assigned to a beat. It was called, you know, when you come to school there at Columbia, they assigned you a beat where you go to cover stories like every week, you know. Class assignments and stuff. So it's very practical, you know, kind of study. So anyway, my beat was East Harlem. So I, during that time, you know, one time I went to cover some comedy shows. Like that was the first time I went into this comedy coverage. So I went there to one of those weeks, I went to a club and took in a show. It turned out to be a very fine, you know, show, very fascinating stuff. So I wrote about it for a class, and I kind of got really hooked. I went back subsequently. So it became a thing that I did, like, during my leisure, you know, time, leisure hours and things. But so I wrote about it then, submitted it for class. So during my time at school, I did all of that. Then, of course, fast forward, I graduated, so I kind of left it behind. I became a journalist in the city. First, I worked at a publication. We covered real estate. And hey, if you're in New York City, New York is nothing without real estate.
Yeah.
Ask people like Donald Trump.
Real estate is king there.
Yeah. You know, so, but I, you know, so I covered comedy for the site. Yeah, for the magazine, it was called The Real Deal. I mean, today it's the most prominent, the big real estate publication here. But when I was there, that was, we were kind of starting out. Yeah, so I did that for a while. And then I went into freelance journalism, again, in the city. And then after a while, I decided to become a lawyer again. So I got my license again in New York, you know, to practice law in New York. And as I did that, then some colleagues of mine back at school, you know, they came up with the idea, restless people, you know, they were restless. They wanted to do something big and journalistic and whatever. So it occurred to them to, hey, try comedy. Why don't you cover comedy? And it turned out that back in the day, at the time, there was nobody was really covering comedy from a serious perspective. I mean, there were some comedy websites, but they were just like websites. You know, they were not really like news operations. So, and these guys who came to me, these former colleagues, they were journalists, trained journalists. So the idea was to cover comedy from a professional journalistic angle. So yeah, so it kind of kindled my interest. That suggestion from them kindled my interest in comedy again, because, you know, I had done this, I had enjoyed it when I did it before. So that's the story about how we began, you know, the website. We covered comedy like extensively, lots of clubs, lots of comedians. So yeah, we did all of that for a while. And then, you know, while I did that, I was also blogging. on the side,
Okay.
again, on comedy issues and stuff. And I had a lot of fans, interacting with me, giving me their sense of, what the sub whether the subject, whether the coverage was helpful to them or not. And then, they were asking questions. So it was really something, a lot of fun to do. So I did that simultaneously as, I covered I worked at Comedy Beat as an editor and occasionally as a reporter on the ground. So yeah. So that's how come I was in that space.
So how did you started doing the comedy and you started covering the comedy, doing the lawyer aspect of the comedy. And I've run through and I've read some of your information on O'Carroll's Law, the different cases out there, your opinion on them and how that went through. Were you getting a lot of feedback from other comedians that were reading that and going, oh, that really helped me. Oh, now I know what to do, what I don't want to do. Is that kind of how it kind of continued to keep growing then?
Yes, actually, because you're right. I'm glad you brought that up. See, when I started that, it was just out of curiosity that I saw a guy with a problem. So I decided, oh, okay, let me just move into a different lane today and just cover this legal problem that he had. And it was kind of fascinating to me. So I covered that, and then I got some reactions to it. Some were happy, some were not. Then
You're going
I
to get that no matter what you do.
decided, yeah. I decided to do more coverage on new cases that kept coming up. Then some of my fans, who were reading the writings, sometimes they suggested to me that, oh, this guy has a problem, now how about this? And then, I'll cover that. So it was like a lot of interaction. And then, so the thing took on a life of its own. It was so such fun, it's like it wasn't something that I could just drop because it was not really big. People loved it, so yeah. So I just kept going and going. So every month I covered something new, something different. And then I kept getting all these fan reaction back and forth. So ultimately, yeah, that's how the book eventually came from the blog, like the subjects I covered and
I was
But
going to say,
they are very interesting.
is that pretty much how the book started? Was you started just doing these, looking at the cases, giving your take on them, and then people commenting back and going, oh, that would make a good book. So I've read some of the ones in there and they're very good. Is there any of your favorites of the cases you've covered? Is there any favorites or ones that stand out to you?
Yeah, first of all, I didn't set out to write a book at all. I didn't even set out to write a blog covering these kinds of things. We just set out to cover comedy as a news operation, and I kind of fell into the blogging and the stories and things that I covered. And the only reason I covered them was I was a lawyer and I was intrigued by these things. I mean, if I were just a journalist, I wouldn't have been interested in that because it involved the law and the intricacies of law life and things like that. But being a lawyer, that was old hat to me. I knew how that worked. So I didn't have to go to a lawyer to explain that to me, as I was a lawyer. So yeah, so that's kind of how I decided to like intersect the two, comedy and the law. Anyway, but with respect to, which subjects were my favorite? Look, I have seven chapters in the book, which is like if you're a comedian, it's a 360, coverage of your life from start to finish, cradle to grave, as they say. But so I mean, ideally, I would say I like all the chapters, but if somebody didn't have a lot of time to read, the whole book, I mean, we hear about people not having much re mental energy to just read and read and, so yeah. So in that kind of society that we are today, where folks don't tend to read much anymore, if
Right.
somebody wanted to read like just one chapter in this book, just one chapter in this book, I'd say go to chapter two that covers free speech. Then that chapter is so relevant to everybody, whether you're a comedian or you're not a comedian. That's why I would say, yeah, that's the real, I would say that's the emblematic chapter in the book. Because and then it happens to be the biggest chapter in the book too, with lots of cases, and it covers stories involving every comedian you could imagine, almost, whether it's Jerry Seinfeld or Jimmy Kimmel or Jay Leno, or John Oliver, Michael Che, and every you just name it, Conan O'Brien, because these guys have all had cases, and the whole idea of the book was to illustrate these issues using real life stories. So I wasn't talking about things in the abstract. No, this has happened. These things have happened to real people, and these are real people that you know, and things that you can relate to, and they carry a lot of lessons for the rest of us, especially even those who are not comedians.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things when I was going through it is there was a case in there where one of them, they had a regular job and then they were moonlighting as a comedian. And then it was deemed that that wasn't appropriate for their job. And as that happened, then they were let go of their job and it went through the whole litigation of them getting it back. And that's something really I feel is very near and dear to my heart because there's a lot of people in the industry of health and wellness where a lot of them are moonlighting off to the side. They're doing that side hustle as they're gaining their business, getting that up enough where they can maybe transition to that
Right.
business. But I've talked to numerous people where they're afraid that they're going to lose their job. So, how does that First Amendment go with what you do on the side in your normal job?
Well, I don't know the particular situation you're talking about, because I have one on the blog right now about somebody who got canned for moonlighting as a comedian. He's a journalist who is associated with the NPR station in Philadelphia. I mean, he sued and he got his job back, but they made him like scrub some of the comedy things, products he had placed on social media and things like that. But the one I have in the book, which is separate, is something about a guy who was a judge.
Yes.
Okay, that's the one you mean.
That's the one I read. Yep.
So he was a judge in New Jersey, municipal judge, and then he was also moonlighting on the side as a comedian. And this guy happens to be a friend of mine, so I mean, I've met him. We've discussed this issue. We've actually discussed this case. That was why the case was pending before the authorities in New Jersey. Anyway, so he was moonlighting, and then he was a judge. He covered lots of issues about drunk driving and people fighting or public urination, all these kinds of stuff that a comedian would really go to town on. You could read a lot of stuff, from the kind of cases that come before you as a judge, especially the kind of judge he was, a municipal judge. He covers those kinds of really stories every day, sorts of stuff. And then on the side, he was moonlighting as a comedian. Now, when he was a comedian, he would talk about like stuff about what, not liking children, or stuff that comedians kind of like to do, not liking children, not wanting to have any children. Then he would talk about things about women and national origin, and then religion, those sensitive subjects. So anyway, so the New Jersey authorities, the people who were the Supreme Court of New Jersey, the people who were the authorities in the law. So they wrote him up on some complaint, as a judge, said, well, look, how could you be a judge and be a comedian? These two things, they seem incompatible with one another. I mean, being a comedian and the kinds of things you talk about, they seem incompatible with the life of a judge. We believe, I mean, how could you assure people who come before you that if you had people who are children, people who are religious, and all those people, if they came before you as a judge, that your opinion as a comedian about these people wouldn't affect your ability to, give them a fair trial, that kind of thing. So that was the real thing that concerned, the authorities. But this guy had He was smart the way he did defend because he had what you could call a Chinese wall, between, his life as a comedian and his life as a judge. In his life as a judge, he is Judge, Vincent Sicari. In his life as a comedian, he was Vince August, a different name. And when he worked as a comedian, he didn't ever mention that he was a judge, ever. He would just go on like any other comedian, And then, I mean, you had to like really be looking for very intimate information about him to be able to discover that he was actually a judge. I mean, you almost have to follow him home and see where he goes to work the next day for you to even discover that he was a judge. I mean, this was how careful he was to keep those two lives separate and apart. And then, of course,
Is that something you would recommend to anyone who is doing any sort of moonlighting, side hustle type of thing to really keep two separate lives, very, very separate lives with things, as far as according to the law, to protect you according to the law?
as it's more of a practical thing in terms of like you keep them separate and not let one interfere with the other. Okay, so that way you are able to like put people at ease, not worry that what I mean, you see, being a judge is different from being a journalist. When you're a judge, you stand in a certain position in society. People come before you helpless, they are looking for justice. So it's a very different kind of thing than the other guy who was working as a journalist who had the same problems. The one difference here is the guy who was working as a journalist, he was talking about his life as a journalist on stage.
Oh, that I see. Yeah, that's huge.
Doing that, and then his the newspaper, NPR said, well, that was an embarrassing thing to them, that those things he was saying were homophobic and misogynistic and even racist, that they didn't want to be associated with that kind of thing, as a news operation, NPR. So they didn't want that kind of, they said they didn't want that kind of association, that people could connect his comedy work to his job in the media. So that was a real friction point for him. And ultimately, when Oh, so they fired him, and then he took them to court. So they ended up in arbitration, and the arbitrator ended up saying, "Well, look, it's a First Amendment issue. He's allowed to do all of that, but the employers also have genuine, legitimate concerns about maybe not wanting this kind of image, for their, office and their service." So the compromise was where he was told to. Yeah, look, say, well, you can go back to these people and get your job back, but you have to scrub, the comedy coverage you have put on social media, that links you to this operation here. But if you are not willing to do that, then you can come back there. But if you are willing to, if you want to go back there, then you're gonna have to do that. So that's how that ended for him. So he got the protection of the law. The law says, yeah, it's First Amendment, you got to let him do, but as long as what he's doing is not somehow negatively impacting his day job. So that's where it goes. But now, the one I was talking about in the book, it ended up with a different result. And I'll let your readers check it out, see the book for how the thing ended. But what made the difference was, so First Amendment is a free country. You could do whatever you want, but how does it impact your job? So the rule of thumb is, for those out there listening who don't want to have problems, when they moonlight, say as a comedian, you probably want to do sort of what this judge did in this case, where he like erected a Chinese wall between his life as a comedian and his life as a judge. Except that the judicial authorities in New Jersey still felt that, well, being a judge is unlike anything else in life. It's still, people still come to you. You almost have a sacred job and duty to give people fair treatment and justice and everything. That if somebody comes before your court, it is true that You may be fair to them, but how about the perception? As they say, justice must not only be done, but must be seen to have been done, must be perceived to have been done. So they are saying, yeah, so maybe you can still be okay and fair with them, but how is the perception there? You know, how do people perceive? So that was where he had a problem, you know, that aspect there. So I mean, I would let your readers check out the book and see how it ended. But it was very interesting, you know, resolution to that. But the lesson from that is, you know, find a way to like keep those two things apart. If you can do that, yeah, you can probably prevail in court if they push you.
I think that's really important for people to realize when they're doing anything, when you're doing anything on the side like that, you need to keep everything separate. You need to not bring one into the other, not to cross them over in any way, shape, mean, or form. Because seems like any little misstep on that is grounds for a lawsuit, really, to
Yeah.
bring it in.
I mean, your employers have a job to do. The people who work with you, you know, they also have a legitimate right to, you know, have the operation, have authenticity and integrity, and not have anything be impacted by, you know, your other side hustle. So, you know, you want to be careful the way you do that. So as long as you can do that, you can maintain that, you know, line of partition between those two things. So one doesn't affect the other. Yeah, you'll be okay. You'll be okay.
That's good. Good to know. And there's a lot of, like I said, going through some of your book, going through some of your blog, there is some great cases out there where you covered some very high profile cases and kind of went in depth on them to say, to kind of give you the behind the scenes. And I know there's a lot of people out there who love the behind the scenes stuff out there.
Well, that's the most interesting, right? That's
Absolutely.
The most interesting about the whole thing, the things you don't see.
And that's it. It's the things you don't see, the things you don't understand. And by kind of opening that up, because I know there's like the true crime people, all the different aspects. Okay, what's going on? It's knowing the ending to it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I went through your book and I was on page 88. You had in your new book, Comedy Goes to Court, you talk about defamation lawsuits and how even if the information was made falsely about a person and it was proven to be false, which was changed in the 1960s, that person could still lose the lawsuit. Can you explain? This was on the chapter on British comedian Frankie Boyle in 2013 and the difference between public figures, regular people, and what is actually considered a public figure.
Yeah, you see, that's a very interesting case. One of the best cases, really, in that case, because now you're comparing life in Britain to life
Right.
in America. And both societies are, you know, they are sister societies. Both of them are free societies, but America is different. And that's where our First Amendment sets us apart from every other society in the world. It gives us the kind of freedom that other people in other places could only, you know, imagine, you know. And in this country, Americans are born believing that there is a free country. They have the freedom to, you know, live their lives as long as obviously they are not breaking the law or negatively impacting somebody else's freedom. You know, so as long as they are not doing that, Americans believe that freedom is their right. I mean, if you go to New Hampshire, it's like live free or die. I mean, that's the American spirit.
How is that different from you growing up?
Different
have
from
you, have, have you was there any differences in you with your, let's just say, because you're originally from this country or
yeah.
from okay and from your the ones who immigrated here, or did you immigrate, did they bring here? Is it different in the country you're originally from?
It's different. I mean, the First Amendment is, you know, like it sets America apart from any other place. You know, there is no other country that has the First Amendment equivalent of it. I mean, other countries have, you know, freedom of speech. If you go to Canada, you know, yeah, you know, you have free speech. You know, they take that kind of thing as some kind of index of being a civilized society. So everybody, you know, talks about being, you know, free speech is in the Canadian constitution, in Britain, they don't have a written constitution, but it's in the laws. So in America, there is free speech under the First Amendment, which sets it apart, makes it different in the sense that free speech allows you a lot of leeway to speak and not get, harmed in any way by the authorities. And the line there, what the idea behind free speech is, where they say that debate about matters of public policy must be uninhibited, robust, and wide open. Quote, uninhibited, robust, and wide open. That's the underlying sentiment about free speech in America under the Constitution, as interpreted by the Supreme Court. Now, so if you're a public figure, the idea is because they want to have First Amendment protections, and people want to be able to speak in a very uninhibited and robust way. So they created this rule that for you to, if you're a public figure, for you to win against somebody who is suing you for defamation, that you have to prove that the person knew that what they were saying was false, or they were so reckless that they could have found out upon very, very little examination that what they were saying was probably false. In other words, they either knew it was false, or they were so reckless that if only they checked just a little, they would have found it was false.
Just a little. So it's okay if it's false, but you didn't check. Is that
Exactly. If it's false or you didn't check, if you're dealing with let's say a guy is a police commissioner or a mayor, and you say something about the mayor that in some particulars, some aspects of it, we are wrong. But if the mayor cannot prove that you did that deliberately, then that's it. He cannot win. If he
Interesting.
cannot prove that you did that deliberately, or that you were so reckless that if only you would have checked just a little, you would have found it wasn't true. And this is a very high standard. Actual malice. It's called actual malice. That's the standard. It came out in 1964, a case involving the New York Times. Some case from Alabama, police commissioner being sued and civil rights people. So yeah. So that's been the standard in this country that if you're a public figure, you cannot win against a citizen who wants to, as long as the person is talking about something in the public interest, a matter of public interest. Let's say maybe police regulations or maybe health or sanitary conditions or entertainment, something in the public sphere or voting rights. As long as it's any of these things, you cannot win unless you can show malice and things. But that's for public figures. But if you're just an ordinary person, you're just a guy riding the subway in New York City, going to from one place to the other, and then you didn't do anything to put you in the public eye. And then some person, journalist or whoever, says something about you that is a false statement of fact. Because when you talk about defamation, you're talking about a false statement of fact that diminishes somebody's reputation in the community. And everybody has the right to have their reputation, not be tarnished by falsehoods. So yeah, so if you're a private person, then the First Amendment doesn't come in. The standard is not actual malice, the one I described. The standard is just very simple, like the kind of thing you will find in England or in Canada or many of these other places. You understand? If you're just a private person. So the intervention about First Amendment is there to protect open and public debate in America about matters of public interest. You understand? So the case I cited, the case you read, the case you just brought up. So this guy was a comedian, actually, where the hunter becomes the hunted, was a comedian. And comedians usually are the people at the receiving end, but now they turn the thing around on this comedian. And this comedian is a really, this guy is a tough actor, tough, bad actor. Like, he's a really bad boy in the sense that he offends people, he punches down, he's, well, some people might call him a son of a bitch, but,
I read some of that about him. It's like a lot of people didn't care for him so much.
Oh, he's a, you know, he's a real, you know, yeah, he's a puncher. He's a real puncher, you know, insult comedian of the worst kind. I mean, he would insult the queen. He would insult anybody. You know, that's just who he was. But this time around, they turned the tables on him. The Daily Mirror, one of the biggest, largest papers in England, very influential, you know, wrote a story about him where they portrayed him as a racist and a misogynist and everything. And he didn't like that. He sued them, and then he won because, you know, they brought up some instances where he said some things, but they said, well, the court said, well, you know, this, it doesn't mean that he's a racist. This was just his opinion, whatever, you know. So ultimately the court said, well, yeah, you know, this is it. You can't, we know you're talking about the public interest by talking about racism and things, but still, you know, you, fact is, this is a false statement of fact. You know, the things you rely on to say that he was a racist, they didn't happen, and they didn't mean that he's a racist. So yeah, so he lost, and they lost, and he won.
And he won.
Yeah,
And
but
that's.
if, yeah, in America, no, it would have been very difficult for him to win that kind of case because, you know, he'd have to be seen as a public figure, and then they'll be talking about a matter of public interest. So for him to win, he'd have to show that they knew that what they were saying was false, or that they were so reckless that if only they would have checked just a little. And it's a high standard.
I just found it very fascinating because I didn't realize that was part of the US law
Yeah.
that they could, you know, you could, you know, be a little false and it would still be okay. And I'm like,
Yeah, you
it
could be
just
wrong and you still be okay, you know.
and I just found that fascinating. And I talk to I've got other people in other countries I talk with and they're like, yeah, that would never fly here. And
No,
I'm like,
no, no, no.
why in the
America
world
is
would.
different like that. America is a very different place.
Do you think, just your personal opinion, do you think the laws are better for the First Amendment here than in other countries? I mean, other countries don't have the actual First Amendment, but do you feel they're better here for people in general, or is there some leeway in there?
I mean, more freedom is always a good thing. I mean, there are things you could get in trouble for overseas that you could never get in trouble for them here. Like in Canada, if you, a comedian just got fined heavily for one of the cases I have in the book, he attacked a disabled kid, a kid who has some serious disability, you know, brain malfunction. He looked very, there was a way, he very funny look and everything. He was just disabled. And then this comedian, like, descended on him in one of his shows, saying that he wishes the kid would die. He couldn't understand why the kid was still alive, you know, that the kid is not a fraud. It just really took a shot at the kid. Because, well, this kid, there was public sympathy for him, and so he sang for the Pope, he sang with Celine Dion. So he became something of a celebrity in Canada. And then this comedian said, well, that the only reason he sympathized with that kid was because he thought the kid will soon die. That, you know, since the kid is still alive, that, well, maybe this is a you know, like, maybe this is a clown or something, you know, that he would wish this kid would die. That the kid, after, you know, that after all, this kid doesn't really have any talent. This is just, people are just sympathetic and everything. So, you know, he took shots at this kid. And then, so some people got offended and then took him up before the, Human Rights Commission in Canada. And then ended up, you know, putting some serious fines on him that he offended the dignity of the kid, you know, the dignity of the kid and the kid's right to live a life of opportunity and all that stuff, you know. So, you know, in other words, if you attack somebody else's dignity, then, you know, yeah, in a way that people believe is insensitive, then you could be found liable and stuff. But that was Canada. There is no First Amendment in Canada. In this country, it could never happen here. You know, comedians attack anybody all the time, anybody they want. You know, some people like Dave Chappelle, he says he likes to punch down at people who are vulnerable. You know, he's been doing things at Netflix, attacking transgender people, you know, people like Daniel Tosh. They attack women who have been raped. People like Tracy Morgan, they attacked gay people. And then so it happens here all the time, and you cannot do anything to those people because this is America. If they tried that in Canada, they would string them up.
It's amazing the differences between the countries, and that's one thing I was fascinated just going through the differences in the law between the countries, and the law here, the law of Canada, the law in England is just so different.
And these are countries that are close to each other.
Absolutely.
That's the blessing of the First Amendment. It makes America different from any other society you can imagine.
So when you there's one thing in there you talked about the public figure in the First Amendment. What do they classify as a public figure?
Well, obviously, I mean, if I mentioned a mayor to you, that's obviously a public figure. Somebody who is a member of Congress or a city council person, these are public figures. Or maybe, these are public officials. They are figures too. But public figures could also include celebrities. Tom Cruise is obviously a public figure, Conan O'Brien, or maybe you name it, maybe Don Lemon, whoever, Matt Lauer, all these people that you see in the public space, Madonna, Taylor Swift, these are all public figures. So for these people to win a defamation suit against you, for instance, they have to prove, again, the standard I just gave you, which is a much higher standard than, the regular standard that applies to everybody. So if you say something about Taylor Swift and she sues you, you stand on a different level than maybe the grocery store clerk who sues you. Two different things. The grocery store clerk can more easily win the case against you than Taylor Swift, because for Taylor Swift, as a public figure, the standard is much higher.
Interesting.
Much
That's
higher.
very interesting how they made that differentiation between the public figure and the regular. And I know there's like different people in a lot of the holistic avenues where they have their own business, they're out there, and I know a lot of them are like, am I the public figure aspect, or am I just a regular, Joe, or what am I,
Now, there's a difference. You can become a limited public figure. Let's say you might be a private figure and then something happens and you become a limited public figure. The example I can give is I think in 2009, there was this pilot of a helicopter that landed on the Hudson. Was Captain Shelley Sullenberger. I mean, for those who follow that news. So there were people got on the plane, and then the plane developed some problems, and then this guy heroically, very heroically, landed this thing on the Hudson safely, and nobody got hurt. So it was big news at the time. He was in the public eye because of that, because it was a news that a lot of people were watching. So his name, became like, oh, he's an American hero. So that makes him a public figure in a limited sense. You understand? Because of that incident. So incidents can make you go from private person to a public figure.
Interesting.
Yeah, for that kind of. So in that kind of situation, I mean, he's not Taylor Swift, but now he has become a public figure too, because he has also come into the public imagination. So he becomes a public figure, what they call a limited public figure.
So does that limited public figure also go over into, like, say, business owners with a storefront or anything like that, or does it not touch that? Where is
Well,
Where's that line?
sorry, finish.
Where is that line where you go from limited public figure to public, or to ordinary citizen, to being in some facet of
Yeah, I think you cut out the last few seconds.
because I'm just wondering, what is the line between going from a normal citizen, let's say, to a limited public figure or someone? public figure.
The line is the news. Like, oh, I have one case here in the book where a case involving Joe McHale, the comedian. He used to host The Soup, a show on ETV. So it was a defamation case in the book about some. There's this Reynolds, a couple in New Jersey, Reynolds. The Reynolds is, a dwarf couple. The husband, they were dwarfs. So they gave an interview to Associated Press where they were talking about, oh, they'd like to, even though they were very short and dwarfish, that they'd like to have perfect babies, that kind of thing. So it was a whole AP story, Associated Press story, that what people read the story and everything. So now people became aware of that. Now, Joe McHale decided to attack them, saying that, they were like dwarfs who couldn't stop procreating and everything. Just made fun of them in his show, The Soup. And he brought this photo montage that you see on The Daily Show, those kinds of things where they laugh at people, put them in all sorts of funny poses and everything. So yeah, so he did that with this couple. And then they turned around and they sold him.
Interesting.
So they turned out, it became like, oh, well, they have become public figures because of that interview with the Associated Press and the public interest in their story. You understand? So for that, they have become, so that's where that's kind of where the line is. If some incident or event propels you into the public sphere where everybody now sees you, maybe a few minutes ago, a few minutes before then, you were nothing, but now this happens and suddenly, you're in the public eye. So you become a public figure in that sense. And then the standard rises. I mean, you cannot just win unless you scale that big hurdle for public figures.
So that's why it's so difficult for a lot of the public figures to win a lot of those defamation
Very
lawsuits out
difficult.
there
In America, very difficult.
in America.
In America.
Interesting.
In other places, no, they can win. Is it like, Frankie Boyle, he won in Britain. The case we talked about, if he was in this country, it would be tough.
That would be, yeah. I was just, it's just surprising, and I encourage everybody to go get your book. Because there is so many cases in there. It's like I was going through it. I'm like, oh my God, which ones do I
No, I
pick to
know.
bring out? And they're just so interesting to really get more of that behind the scenes look at it. And as you've been doing that, your opinion, there's satire in free speech. And how does that satire, what role does satire play in free speech? Can people say anything or not really? What's the legal aspects on satire?
Well, satire is one of those things that are protected under the First Amendment, and the First Amendment gives you a lot of leeway. And satire, first of all, is supposed to be something that is beneficial to society because on its own, satire tries to like make a mockery of what people feel are going bad in society, and the expectation is that the mockery you make of it could somehow prod the people doing those things to, change for the better. So that's that kind of utilitarian role that satire plays in our society. So satire is protected from the very get-go. Now, in America, where there is the First Amendment, the protection is even bigger. I mean, if you're a comedian, there is no, you don't have greater protection than any other citizen here. It's just that because of the kind of work you do, you are the person that tends to get into those situations that require this protection. So that's the sense in which comedians are more involved in these situations. But they don't have more rights than any other citizen. It's just that, like I said, they get involved more with these situations, which means that now what does it mean? It means that they are kind of like our representatives in these free speech battles. If they lose, we kind of lose because they don't have more rights than us. They have as much rights as us. But because they are the ones who talk for a living and they talk in a way that offends people in a society addicted to litigation like America. I mean, litigation in America is like a disease. I mean, we will literally sue anything that moves in this country.
That's the whole thing. It seems like everything is up to be sued for everything.
So, comedians, because of the kind of work they do, they talk for a living, they make fun of people and of things. So they are bound to offend, people who file lawsuits in a place like America. So they're coming to the crosshairs of people filing lawsuits for that reason. So they become our proxies in the fight over free speech. If they lose, we lose because they have as much rights as the rest of us. And if you can protect those who fly closest to the sun when it comes to offensive speech, if you can protect those who fly the closest to the sun, then you can protect all the rest of the people who don't fly as close to the sun as the comedians. You understand? So it's that whole thing. That's why they like are our proxies in the fight. If they lose, we lose. And in this book, I have so many instances where I demonstrate, like the dimensions of free speech with the lives of all these people. And we have we ought to root for them, because if they fail, we fail, as I said. I mean, Elon Musk said something the other time, which I thought was very interesting, even though, look, I don't share his perspectives to life. I mean, he obviously lives his life according to different principles, but he said this one thing that I thought was interesting and true. Something like that, if you can, that free speech means nothing unless you are willing to allow free speech for people you don't like, to be able to say things that you don't like yourself. In other words, unless you're able to allow people you don't like to say things, to be able to say things that you don't like, then you're not really protecting free speech. Which I thought was very true. So
That I feel is so very true, because really, what is free speech? What is freedom? Is the ability to listen or to hear, even if you don't want to listen to it yourself.
exactly.
To have it spoken, to have, ideas and explanations and things you don't agree with, to still be spoken, doesn't mean you have to listen to them, doesn't mean you have to agree with them. But if they can't speak them, then what can you do? What if somebody doesn't agree with you after a while? And that's, I think, is something so important that I don't feel speech should be squelched, but it needs to be looked at and say, what's allowed? There's a lot of things that is allowed under the law, from what I'm seeing. There's a heck of a lot that's allowed, which is
The
good.
law, yeah. The law allows you to be, if you want to be racist in this country, yeah. The First Amendment, yeah, you can be racist. You're not breaking the law by being racist or by being misogynistic or by being anti-Semitic. I mean, you can see all the, controversy over anti-Semitism since the Hamas war. But that's America, it's a free country like that. You can do all of that thing, and the First Amendment protects you. But that's the court. But then there's a court of public opinion on the other side. People may counsel you, even though under the law you have the right to say or do what you did. But there's the court of public opinion out there.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. It's the is it acceptable? Is it legally acceptable? Yeah. Should you be doing stuff like that? No. If you're a comedian, it's one thing you can do that. But as normal everyday people, you should really treat people the way you want to be treated
I
and
know.
go
Well,
through the whole thing. That's one thing that this is really a good show on education. What is free speech? What can we do? How can you help yourself? And if you're doing a second job, protecting yourself of keeping everything separate, it's really important to know. And it's, there's a lot of people in the community I go in, which is the holistic and the wellness, and they're maybe saying things that other people might look at as like, eh, that's a little out there. Agree with this.
happens, definitely happens,
But the thing is, you're still allowed to speak it, and that's the whole thing, is you're still allowed to speak it, doing it in a way of compassion, not being mean, not being, nasty, racist, going after people. That's crazy stuff. But just to know you have the rights behind you if you ever need them, because sometimes things people say can be misconstrued. And have you come across different cases where they're kind of misconstrued over what was originally said and making taken out of context and things like that? Take like information or that someone says, and it's taken out of context and made to look completely different than the original meaning of it. Is that something that people have to worry about a lot, or is it something where it's like, do you have to have everything you yourself say recorded just to kind of protect yourself on that aspect? Or is defamation, and because a lot of times that could be considered a defamation, is that something where you don't have to worry about as much, or what's your opinion on that?
Well, it depends on the sector you're dealing with. If you're like in the comedy space and you're saying these things to get a joke or something, okay. So a lot of times, a comedian is perceived to maybe just be making a joke. And if you misunderstand, if you take it the wrong way, I mean, like an example, where I'll give you an example with Jerry Seinfeld.
Okay.
There was this time he appeared, 2011, I think it was. He appeared on the Jay Leno, sorry, the David Letterman show. And then, he was discussing what happened with his wife. Now, the backstory here is his wife wrote a book on, a cookbook, right? And then the book did so well. And then some other person sued the wife, that the wife plagiarized her book. Jerry Seinfeld's wife won that case, right? The court ended up saying no, that she didn't plagiarize the book. The idea was too general. The idea of putting puree into foods and things like that, it was too general that you couldn't, like, you wouldn't be allowed to have a copyright on that kind of thing. You don't copyright something that's so general. You copyright something that's kind of specific to you, creative and things. Anyway, but yeah, so they say, well, no, she didn't copyright it. So Jerry Seinfeld's wife won. Now Seinfeld goes on David Letterman, and then the conversation came up, and then he started to like attack the woman who sued his wife.
Oh,
He
okay.
said, well, that she has a three, she has a three names, that people with three names are oftentimes assassins in the course of history. He talked about Mark David Chapman, James Earl Ray, the guy who killed, who shot Martin Luther King Jr., that kind of thing. So he said, yeah, all these people who have all these three names, that usually they are assassins, they are wacko, they are, that. So he like really attacked the woman in that way. So, okay. Now, she turns around and then she sues him. For defamation, obviously. And then, so the court ended up, so the court said, yeah, that she sues him, then she sues David Letterman and CBS and everything. And then the court said, well, no, look, that this guy is a comedian. He was appearing on a comedy show, an important comedy show that has a national audience. And when he was talking, people perceived him as not making a statement of fact, but just an opinion. That idea that this woman is is a wacko, or an assassin because of her name, that it's just an opinion, that nobody listening to Jerry Seinfeld on that show would have thought that Jerry Seinfeld was making a statement of fact that this woman was actually a wacko, that. So yeah, that it's so that kind of thing. So you could, like, it depends on the context. If people understand what you are saying as a joke, just like as your opinion, and not as a statement of fact, then you're not going to get in trouble. But you could also get in trouble in very few cases, like a case where, the case I covered here with Jim Norton. Jim Norton, he attacked a lawyer, an anti-feminist lawyer, on the Opie and Anthony show. Jim Norton said that the lawyer was a whore who wanted to have sex with a chicken, just crazy stuff. And the lawyer sued him. Again, eventually Jim Norton won because, again, the court said, well, nobody listening to that show would think that Jim Norton literally meant that this guy was a whore. It's not defamation, that Jim Norton was just a comedian wanting to make people laugh on a show and everything. So, but there is a situation where you can actually be liable. One of the few cases for defamation, even if you're a funny person, a comedian. I mean, I have it in this book with the Joe Norton situation, where this was in Australia in 2011, July sometime, 2011. There was this TV show they called Channel 10 in Australia.
Okay.
Before the Game, that's the name of the show, Before the Game. So one comedian goes on that show, and then he talked about a woman who was a woman who was a politician, a member of parliament, a political figure, a national figure. Her name was Nicole Corns, and then this comedian was Mick Molloy. So Molloy was saying that this woman, that she slept with some player on her husband's team. Her husband was a football coach. So this comedian was saying that she slept with one of those players. Well, this was some scene. So the case, so she sued him, of course, for defamation. Then he tried to argue that, he's a comedian, this was a humorous show. The court said, no, this goes too far. You did not make a joke. You made a statement of fact. The statement could be proven true or not. You said she slept with this person. If she didn't sleep with that person, that's a false statement of fact. And the thing has diminished her reputation in the community. So that was defamation right there. Something I covered in the book. So one of the few cases where, you could be liable for defamation, even though you're just a comedian trying to make a joke. If what you say goes into the territory of a statement of fact instead of opinion, if it's a statement of fact instead of opinion, and if that fact happens to be wrong and false, then that's it, So that woman either slept with that player or she didn't. Well, obviously she didn't. So he was making a false statement of fact that diminished her reputation in the country. I mean, this was a politician, a member of parliament. So, her reputation is very important to her. So, yeah. So they won the case against him, even though he was a comedian saying something on a humorous kind of show, So
there's really a, there is a fine line in there.
Real line there somewhere.
And I think that's something really important for people to realize, that the comedians, when they're doing that, when we're talking about free speech but just free speech in general, to know they are, like you said, they're flying close to the sun. They're up there. They're pushing the limits quite
Definitely.
A bit, a lot of times.
A lot of times, you want to be edgy. They want to be edgy. I mean, that's important in comedy, to be edgy. And that edge is a very offensive kind of thing, the edge. So, that's where the trouble arises. How far do you move the edge? Do you cross the line, or do you still, can you still stay within the line and remain edgy? Well, it's always something to be negotiated constantly.
But I think that's important for people to know, don't try to squelch this free speech that's out there. Don't try to, make it so people can't speak, but instead,
right.
Turn your ear if you need to,
exactly.
But let people talk. That's what it's all about. It's the, when they cross the line, like Lee said, when the one, ones go physical and things like
yeah.
that, then you're crossing the line. You're crossing the line for sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you, there's this story. I don't know if you read it. It got to that part. You can cross the line, yeah, if you go physical. I mean, if you know this comedian, Andy Dick, on the West Coast, he's one of the famous, one time he crossed the line, on the stage. He actually committed battery on somebody. He was doing a show, wearing a skirt. I have it in the book somewhere, I think, chapter 4 or whatever. Where he went too far, like off the deep end. He was doing a show, and then they booked him, and then, for a show. And then there was a member of the audience that was sitting right close to the aisle. And then this guy, he was performing wearing a skirt, a female skirt, and then no underwear. And then that was how he was performing. The one time, everything got so hot and heavy, so he came down from the stage and was walking down the aisle, as comedians say, to walk the room, to walk the room. So as he was going down the stage, down the aisle toward the back end. So there was this guy who was sitting like close to the aisle. So the guy tried to ask for an autograph. So Aunt Dick stopped, looked at the guy, said, "Oh, you want an autograph? Okay, here's an autograph." So he grabbed the guy's head, pulled up his skirt and shot the guy's head on his, against his crotch. His back, he wasn't wearing any underwear. And then just held it there and squeezed it there and then let the guy go. Then he went on. So the show ended, but this guy was so offended, the fan, he was so offended that he turned around and sued everybody in sight. He sued Andy Dick, he sued the production company, he sued the comedy club, and he sued anybody he could find.
That's the thing. It's like you've got to know the limits to what's acceptable out there.
He
You
went too,
need to
I mean,
know
he
them.
went too far. I mean, it wasn't funny. I mean, nobody appreciated his sense of humor with that. So, I mean, it's not, the First Amendment cannot protect you there, but that's just too far.
Right.
Of course, he ended up being liable. I mean, death settled, but he was liable, But the comedy club was not liable because nobody could have predicted what he would do. It was an
Right.
intentional thought, I mean, he, like, because the man who brought the lawsuit said, well, that the comedy club should have protected him against this kind of behavior, that they were negligent because they did not. And the court said, no, but you can say they were negligent if they could have foreseen that this thing could happen and didn't prevent it. There was no way they could know that this guy was going to suddenly develop a wild hair and do this to a guy just on the in the audience, that kind of thing. So you have to actually show that they could have foreseen that this would happen. I mean, if he did that before, let's say that's what he does all the time, and they know that, yeah, he behaves like this, then under the law, they are required to take precautions to make sure that he didn't like do this. But this was something that came out of nowhere, and so you cannot hold them liable. So only the guy himself who did the thing, Andy Dick, was liable. Not the comedy club, not the show promoters, nobody else but him. So yeah, you can comedians can sometimes go too far, like the rest of us. I mean, if it was me or you who did that kind of thing, yeah, we'd be liable too. So comedians don't have more rights than anybody else, but like I said before, we have to root for them because they are often the people in these situations where they do the things that could apply to us too. That if they lose their rights, then we also lose our rights. So, it's important that they are able to like maintain those rights and hold the line. So, oh, by the way, the story I was telling about the woman in Australia, if that would have happened in this country, First Amendment or no First Amendment, the comedian still would have been liable. Because he made a false statement of fact. False. You understand? So that's where the line is. Once the thing is false, even if you're dealing with a public figure, in this case, she was a politician. Even if you're dealing with a public figure, even if it's Taylor Swift, once the thing is wrong, factually wrong, a statement of fact that is false, then yeah, you're liable. The First Amendment is not going to save you. You'll be liable even though the standard is very, very high.
I see.
Yeah.
That's good to know. And I think, that's the thing. There's so much information in here for people to understand more about the law and how you can work within it, how you want to be aware of it. I think that's the thing. For me, I'd rather be aware of what there is out there than not aware. And that's something I think more people should pay attention to. And I just want to encourage everybody to go check out your website. And it is your website is O'Carroll's Law. And they will check on there, check out your blog, O'Carroll's Law. And there's a comedy dialogue. There's so much information out there for you. And your new book, When Comedy Goes to Court, when people
Yeah,
would.
yes.
Right there. There is so much great information in there. Whether you're a comedian or not, there's a lot of great information if you're a comedian. There's a lot of great information just understanding the law at a lot deeper level for everybody. And you do it in a really nice, it's in layman's terms. It's not in, lawyer speak.
No, 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 it's not. It's not.
It's
And no lawyer could have written the book because lawyers speak like lawyers. I was able to write the book because I have a background as a journalist. We
journalists.
tell stories. That's what we do as journalists. We tell stories. The kind of stuff. If you read the New York Times or People magazine, it's different from reading a law book. Very, very different. So I had to. I come from a background where, I'm a storyteller because I'm a journalist, and then I know the law, so I was able to break it down to very simple language that anybody can follow. But whether you're riding the train, whether you're sitting in the bleachers watching a baseball game, or you're riding the train, the New York City subway, just ordinary guy, ordinary person. You don't have to be highly educated or being a lawyer to follow this. No, you can. So the language is that simple and accessible, colloquial, so to speak.
Absolutely. And it's really, there's a lot of, it's almost like short stories all put together with the different, this lawsuit and this lawsuit and going into the nitty-gritty of it. So it's kind of like, it's like going in and like, oh, I'll do a short story today and I'll check
Right,
this out.
right. Here's the thing. I mean, if you want to read the book for the stories, yeah, you can totally read the book for the stories. The stories are so fascinating, so much titillation here and there, that if you are on a beach, you want to have a beach read, or you go to a mall or a park, wherever you hang out, and you want to read something funny. Yeah, this book can give you the feeling of being at a comedy club, taking in a show, or watching a show on Comedy Central. So it's that kind of simple, language. So if you want to read it just for the stories, yeah, that's good enough. If you also want to read it, I mean, like, this is comedy. Andy Engel, one of our promoters here in New York City, who owns the Manhattan Comedy Club, he said one time that stand-up comedy is addictive. That is the most fun you can have with your clothes on. Which is, if you want to read the thing for the stories, that's big enough and good enough. But if you want to read the thing additionally for something a bit more serious, like all the free speech things we've talked about, and yeah, that's even better. It's, an additional thing. And since this is your audience is not a comedy audience as such, but there's a section in this book where we talk about the relationship between comedians and other people who are not comedians. I don't know if you got to that chapter, but where we have even people who were in romantic relationships with comedians or family members suing them for what they said on stage about their relationship. I mean, case here, like the case on England, Stephen Grant, where the wife was suing him, telling him not to talk about their failed marriage on stage. And then this guy refused. He said, well, that he'd been dying to talk about the marriage on stage for the past 2 years.
I'm thinking that didn't end well.
That's comedy. And then family members sue comedians, sometimes to stop talking about their lives on stage. I mean, yeah, I have this other case where some in-laws from New Jersey, some Jewish in-laws, were suing their African American daughter-in-law from talking about, the family traditions and family practices on stage. Well, in each case, these comedians, they won. But, the lesson being that, if your boyfriend or your husband or your family member is a comedian, well, comedians draw from their life experiences. They are going to talk about you one way or the other. So, and you can't stop them because, again, that's the art form itself.
That's, that would be the line. It's like, what you know when you get into that situation that they're gonna be talking about you no matter what happens. I would think that, I mean, material comes from home usually.
Yeah, they get material from their daily experiences, especially these days where we have what they call observational comedy. People
There
talk
you go.
about their lives, their daily experiences, as a way to like distinguish themselves from other comics, so.
But that's kind of what makes the comedy funny, because other people can relate to it. Oh
They do.
man. But there is so much information. You get the funny stories with it, but you also get the behind the scenes understanding the law
Yeah.
in ways you never would have. It probably would have been dry if you would have just been reading about the law, but with the way you put it in with the stories and The way you put it together is extremely good. I've got to say, the way you put it together is just extremely good. You're getting that information, you're learning, and yet it's fun all at the same time. So I've got to say, kudos for you. You did an awesome job on
Oh,
this
thanks, thanks, thanks. I
one.
hope your readers like it too. But yeah, I mean, I was able to do that because, I was a journalist and then a lawyer. So we tell stories, and then you break down the law so people can understand it. But you begin from the story. You begin
Absolutely.
from the story. So.
I just want, is there anything else you'd like to say before we close this interview, Carl?
Well, very simply, thanks for having me. And the book, I mean, look, one of the reviewers said something about the book that, oh, that any person who is not covered in this book is not important in comedy. Well, I wouldn't go that far, but I can say that we have a lot of stories here that we illustrate with the lives of, people the famous people and everything, not only in this country, but in Britain, in Canada, in Germany, in Turkey, Australia. So yeah, so that and ultimately the book was described as a must read for comedians, and they should read for the rest of us.
I love it. And I've got viewers and listeners in all the countries you mentioned. So, and that's why it'll kind of fit with everyone. There, I've got people all around the world that listen
Oh,
to
very
this. So
wonderful. I welcome them to take a read. They'll love it.
absolutely. It's very good, very fascinating. And I just want to remind everyone again, make sure to go to Carl's website. It is Carl's Law, oldcarlslaw.com, and those links will be down below
And
in
one
the
final
book.
time.
Comedy goes to court when people stop laughing and start fighting. I love the title too. Very poignant for this time in history. So make sure to do that. Check that out. He's also on X and on LinkedIn. So check out Carl there. And I just want to thank you again, Carl. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge, sharing your information here with. It's so important for people to understand that legal aspects of everything they're doing, and you do it in such an easy to understand way, and is extremely good for so many people out there. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm very honored to be on your show. And yeah, this is a wonderful opportunity to share this wonderful art form with people. And yeah, I hope they learn something from it. I also hope they feel entertained from the stories. The stories are like, to die for. So enjoy the stories and learn some law.
Absolutely. And laughter is absolutely important going forward. We all are going to need it. So, thank you again, Carl. I appreciate you sharing your knowledge. And for all of you out there, make sure to watch the next episode of Edge Talk Radio. They're on the first and third Tuesdays of the month at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. And if you missed any past episodes, you can listen to the downloadable podcast, or you can watch the interview on my YouTube channel, Angela Zabel, Teacher Coach Medium. And I just want to thank everyone. Thank you all for listening, expanding, and amplifying our universe together. Have an absolute